welcome to our podcast, Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction about the Middle Ages. I'm your host, Professor Richard Abels. Today, my co-host, Ellen Abels, and I will be talking about a Crusader murder mystery, the assassination of Conrad of Montferrat, king-elect of Jerusalem, by honest-to-God real assassins. Please join us as we try to solve a very cold case. Ellen suggested that we begin with an apology for butchering Arabic names and terms.
To be fair, we've butchered the pronunciation of French and even British place names in past episodes, so our mea culpa in advance.
I think you mean nostri culpi.
Show off. Okay, why don't you talk about the murder?
On the evening of the 28th of April in the year 1192, the newly elected king of Jerusalem, Marquis Conrad of Montferrat, was murdered in the streets of the city of Tyre while returning from dinner with the Bishop of Beauvais. He was assaulted and stabbed to death by two men, members of the Islamic sect of Nizari Ismaili Shia, known as the Assassins. One of the assassins was immediately killed by Conrad's men. The other was captured. It was no mystery who sent them. The assassins were fanatically devoted and obedient to the master of the sect in Syria, Rashid al-Din Sinan, the Old Man of the Mountain. The question was, on whose behalf did Sinan order the killing? Before he died, the captured assassin was apparently tortured into naming King Richard, the Lionheart, the leader of the Third Crusade, and in many ways the de facto king of what remained of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, as the instigator of the murder. Or at least that is what the French crusaders and supporters of Conrad claimed. The assassination of Conrad of Montferrat was the most dramatic event in the turbulent internal politics of Outremer that led up to and continued during the Third Crusade.
Can't say I'm surprised. In previous episodes, we've seen how political rivalries among the leaders of Outremer made the Latin states of the Levant vulnerable to Saladin. King Guy of Lusignan's mistrust of the motivations of Count Raymond III of Tripoli led him to reject the Count's prudent military advice, march his army in midsummer into the waterless scrublands of Galilee, engage Saladin's superior forces at Hattin. And what could go wrong? Everything.
Including the total destruction of the military forces of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, followed by the virtual extinction of the kingdom as Saladin took all of its castles and cities, culminating in his triumphant entry into Jerusalem.
Tyre did hold out, though.
Yes, Tyre was the one city of the Kingdom of Jerusalem that successfully resisted Saladin's siege, and that was because of the arrival by sea of Conrad of Montferrat, the vanguard of the Third Crusade.
I'm also not surprised that political rivalries marked and impeded the Third Crusade itself. I mean, how could anybody expect that a crusade led by King Richard of England and King Philip Augustus of France would go smoothly?
The two had once been friends and allies.
Or even lovers, as some speculate.
Only if one willfully misreads the sources. It's safest to say that their friendship was based on a common interest, their desire to get rid of Richard's formidable father, King Henry II of England. Henry II's death did nothing to resolve the border disputes between the French royal domain and Richard's Duchy of Normandy. Worse, it brought to the fore a personal issue dividing Philip and Richard, Richard's long, long engagement to Philip's sister Alice, who had awaited her marriage in King Henry II's court.
And according to even more speculative rumors, had been Henry's mistress,
which Richard used as an excuse to repudiate the betrothal. Richard's decision to marry Berengaria, the daughter of the King of Navarre, while he prepared for the crusade in Sicily, was a personal affront to Philip. Perhaps just as bad was Richard's apparent reneging on their agreement to split evenly all spoils the two kings took while on crusade. Richard's forces had taken control over the Sicilian city of Messina, where the crusading armies were wintering, and Richard refused to share the loot. He contended that the seizure of Messina was not part of the crusade. Richard claimed that it was a personal matter between him and Tancred, the ruler of Sicily. Philip felt humiliated when Richard ordered his banner raised over the city of Messina.
It also didn't help that Richard also refused to share Cyprus with Philip when Richard took the island before landing an acre. Richard again claimed that his conquest of Cyprus had nothing to do with the crusade, and therefore he owed Philip nada.
Relations between Philip and Richard didn't improve during the siege. The two behaved courteously toward one another, but, as the Anglo-Norman poet Ambroise put it, just like their fathers, they revered each other with tender enmity cloaked in love. It's not surprising that Philip left the crusade shortly after Acre was taken and he received his share of the spoils. Both he and Richard had fallen ill. Philip used his illness as an excuse to return to France, accompanied by a small retinue. Richard clearly distrusted Philip's intentions. He requested that Philip swear an oath of good faith towards him and to not break his word by attacking either his people or his land while Richard remained in Outremer. Richard's suspicions were merited. Philip stopped in Rome before returning to Paris to meet with Pope Celestine III. He asked the pontiff to confirm that he had fulfilled his crusader vow. He also asked to be released from the oath he had sworn to Richard. Unsurprisingly, the pope agreed to the former and turned down the latter.
Okay, this apparently didn't make much of a difference to Philip, but what did this have to do with the murder of Conrad?
To quote Saladin in the film Kingdom of Heaven, when he's asked, "What is Jerusalem worth?" His reply, "Nothing. Everything."
That's unhelpful.
Yeah, it was unhelpful in the film too. The bad blood between Richard and Philip poisoned Richard's relations with both the leaders and rank and file of the French crusading army. They accepted Richard's military leadership and money, but they also resented what they saw as his arrogance. They were willing and maybe even eager to think the worst of Richard, as we shall see.
It's hard not to see Richard as arrogant and maybe a bit of an ass, but didn't he also insult Duke Leopold of Austria?
He did. When Acre was taken, Duke Leopold, as leader of the German crusaders following the deaths of Frederick Barbarossa and his son Frederick, ordered that his banner be placed on the ramparts alongside the banners of the two kings, Richard and Philip.
Okay, and why was doing that a big deal?
By doing this, Duke Leopold was claiming a share of the spoils and equality of rank. Richard ordered that Leopold's banner be thrown down because he was a mere duke and not a king. Publicly humiliated, Leopold left the crusade to return to Austria. A year and a half later, he would get his revenge on Richard.
And he's doing this in the middle of a crusade, okay? Where does Conrad come into all this?
Now, things are going to get a little complicated.
What? Like they weren't before? Okay.
When Philip and Richard arrived at Acre, respectively in late April and early June of 1191, the question of who was king of Jerusalem was up in the air.
There wasn't a kingdom to be king of at that point.
But there was still the title and office of King of Jerusalem. The two men who claimed to be King of Jerusalem were Guy of Lusignan, who had been king, and Conrad of Montferrat.
The dueling egos seemed to be more important to them than actual progress on the crusade, but maybe that's just me. And also, when the last time we talked, Guy was still a captive of Saladin.
Yeah. Saladin released Guy and Sibylla about a year after Hattin. If his intention was to stir up political dissent within what remained of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, it worked. Conrad's appearance at Tyre had turned the tide of the siege. Saladin, his army chafing at the bit to return to their families and lands after campaigning for 4 months, reluctantly called off the siege. Conrad was feted as the savior of the city. Then in 1189, Guy and Sibylla appeared before the gates of the rescued city, with an army that they had assembled in Tripoli. Saladin had freed Guy on condition that he swear to give up the kingdom and leave Outremer. The clergy, however, released Guy from his oath, as he knew they would, because he had sworn it under duress. What Guy didn't expect was that Conrad would refuse to acknowledge his kingship or even allow him or his men to enter the city. To his credit, Guy responded to this humiliation by laying siege to the port city of Acre in hope of redeeming his reputation and preserving his kingship.
By then, he had a lot of practice dealing with humiliation.
Contemporary sources don't vilify Guy of Lusignan. He's not blamed for the misfortunes that befell him, but the best that any of the chroniclers can say about him is that he was a brave and resolute knight. Even the sources favorable to King Richard labor to find good things to say about Guy. The poet Ambrose, for example, described Guy as a doughty knight, straightforward and honest in character. who lacked the cunning needed to retain a kingdom in this fallen world. Unlike Guy, Conrad impressed contemporaries, both supporters and enemies. The Byzantine chronicler Nicetas Koniatas knew him as a man of great valor and keen intellect. Baha al-Din called him the most cunning and experienced of the enemies of Islam. Ibn al-Athir said of him, quote, "He was a devil incarnate in his ability to govern and defend a town, and a man of extraordinary courage." To the late 12th century troubadour and lesser noble Bertrand de Born, whom we've talked about before, Conrad was the valiant and noble marquis. An anonymous late 12th century chronicler described Conrad most fully. He, quote, "He was vigorous in arms, extremely clever both in natural mental ability and by learning, amiable in character indeed, endowed with all the human virtues, supreme in every council, the fair hope of his own side and a blazing lightning bolt to the foe, capable of pretense and dissimulation in politics, educated in every language, in respect of which he was regarded by the less articulate to be extremely fluent."
I'm a little confused. How did Conrad of Montferrat impress his contemporaries when he had just arrived at Tyre? When we were talking about this earlier, I remember you saying that Conrad refused to leave Tyre and join Richard's campaign. So why did he have this reputation as a great warrior?
To begin with, the rulers of the March of Montferrat in the Piedmont of northwestern Italy were among the most distinguished and politically well-connected families of the time. Conrad's cousins included Philip Augustus, the Emperor Frederick Barbarossa, and Duke Leopold of Austria. The family's prestige and connections led Baldwin IV and the High Court of Jerusalem to choose Conrad's elder brother, William Longsword, as husband for Baldwin's sister, Sibylla, in 1176. One of Conrad's younger brothers and Conrad himself married Byzantine princesses. Conrad earned his reputation for bravery and military prowess by fighting for Frederick Barbarossa in the Emperor's War against the Lombard League, and subsequently fighting for the Byzantine Emperor, Manuel Comnenus, against Frederick. He so impressed Manuel that the Emperor in 1179 invited him to join his court in Constantinople. He returned to Montferrat a year later when the Emperor died, but in 1186, the Emperor Isaac Angelos diverted Conrad from his intention of joining his father, Marquis William V, in the Holy Land by offering him his sister in marriage.
So the Montferrat seem to have been heavily invested in crusading.
They were. Conrad's father, William V, went on both the Second and Third Crusades. Two of his sons married heiresses to the Kingdom of Jerusalem, and a third son, Boniface, led the notorious Fourth Crusade that ended in the Crusaders storming and taking Constantinople.
I mean, I read Stephen Runciman's History of the Crusade many years ago, but I vaguely remember him portraying Conrad in a very unflattering light. Didn't he assert that Conrad fled Constantinople and only went to Tripoli because he had murdered somebody?
Yes, Runciman did. And based on Runciman's authority, so did two best-selling popular historians of the Crusades, Karen Armstrong and James Reston. But it is a vile canard, as the historian Marianne MacLeod Gilchrist demonstrated. Conrad had killed a great Byzantine noble, Alexius Braunus, but he did it in battle, and Braunus was a would-be usurper. Conrad may have thought it prudent to fulfill his crusading vows in 1187 to avoid possible retaliation by Braunus's still powerful kinsman, but he wasn't a murderer fleeing justice. Runciman's representation of Conrad of Montferrat as a cunning Machiavellian owes a great deal to Sir Walter Scott's reshaping of Conrad as a stereotypical Gothic Italian villain in The Talisman.
Okay, I can accept that Conrad really was pretty impressive, but what was his claim to the throne? I mean, Guy's claim was through Sibylla. What was his?
Conrad was the brother of Sibylla's first husband, William Longsword of Montferrat. He was also the uncle of the late Child King Baldwin V.
You mean the Leper King?
No, he was the nephew of the Leper King.
Okay, go ahead.
In 1188, he really didn't have a claim beyond that and the fact that he had rescued Tyre from conquest. By the time that Richard and Philip arrived in 1191, his claim was a lot stronger. In 1190, Sibylla fell ill in the unsanitary Crusader camp at Acre and died. This left Guy without a real claim to the kingship other than he had been crowned king as her consort. Conrad took advantage of the situation by marrying Sibylla's younger half-sister and next in line to the throne, Isabella.
Wait a minute, wasn't Isabella married? I mean, weren't all these princesses of Jerusalem married multiple times?
She was married, and she was apparently even happily married to a native baron, Humphrey of Touraine, stepson of the notorious Reynold of Châtillon, and of Stephanie of Milly, heiress to the great crusader territory of Ultra-Jordan. Isabella was 8 years old when she was betrothed to Humphrey, who was then 15, and she was 11 when she was married to him in 1183.
Weren't they married at the famous castle of Carrack?
They did, and it was under siege at the time they were married. It was an exciting wedding, to say the least. Guy's failure to relieve the siege in his capacity as bailiff of the Kingdom of Jerusalem was the last straw for the disillusioned leper king, Baldwin IV. Baldwin, in consultation with the High Court of Jerusalem, passed over his sister's claim to succeed him, naming her son, Baldwin V, who was a child, to be his heir. By 1186, both Baldwins were dead, and the question was who would succeed Baldwin V. The barons of the High Court, led by Count Raymond III of Tripoli, met in Tiberias and chose Isabella and her husband Humphrey, while Baldwin V's bailiff and uncle chose Sibylla and Guy in Jerusalem. Civil war was avoided when Humphrey, in the middle of the night, without telling anyone, snuck away to Jerusalem and did homage to Guy, acknowledging him as king, undercutting his supporters, all of whom fell in line and did homage, except for Count Raymond III of Tripoli and Baldwin of Ibelin. Humphrey became the man who would not be king.
And maybe his being a native had something to do with his own willingness to see a civil war at this dire point in the kingdom's history.
It would be nice to believe that, but virtually everybody involved in this, except for Guy, was a native baron. It may simply have been that Humphrey was by nature timid and just didn't want to have the responsibilities of being king.
But, okay.
So, when Sibylla died in 1190, rather than accepting Guy as king, the native barons turned to Conrad. Conrad was the obvious alternative to Guy. He was in control of the only remaining city of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, Tyre, which also meant that he could set food prices in the city's market. Conrad, like Guy, had no hereditary claim to the throne. To remedy this, he decided to marry Isabella. The one obstacle was that she was already married to Humphrey. No problem. Isabella had been betrothed, as I said, at 8 and married at 11, a year earlier than the legal age of consent for a girl, 12. Thus, the marriage had not been valid, despite Humphrey's and Isabella's protestations that they wished to remain married. Isabella's resistance to divorcing her husband and marrying Conrad was overcome by Isabella's mother and former queen of Jerusalem, Maria Comnena, widow of King Almeric I and wife of Balian of Ibelin. Maria apparently browbeat her daughter into accepting the annulment and marriage to Conrad as a royal duty for the good of the kingdom. The same chronicler who had described the virtues of Conrad concluded his portrait with a caveat. In one thing alone was Conrad regarded as blameworthy, that he had seduced another's wife away from her living husband and made her separate from him and married her himself.
So let me get this straight. So if Conrad's marriage to Isabella was valid, he had a better claim to the kingship than Guy.
Yes.
Okay.
If the marriage was valid, which was questionable. Marriages were supposed to be indissoluble. They were supposed to be forever. Isabella's marriage to Conrad, when she had a living and protesting husband, was controversial in itself. What made it doubly so was that Conrad also had a living spouse.
Say what?
Yeah, he had married the sister of the Byzantine emperor, Isaac Angelus, a few months before he left Constantinople for Outremer. But that marriage may have been dissolved. His wife, Theodora, retired to a convent.
Okay, so I assume that Philip Augustus and Richard took different sides on this,
of
right?
Of course they did, yeah. Philip supported Conrad, who was his cousin, but because he returned to France soon after Acre had been taken, he was not on the scene to affect the outcome of any kind of decision about the succession. The French crusaders on the whole supported Conrad. Richard, on the other hand, supported Guy.
Okay, and did Richard also have a personal reason for supporting Guy, other than that if Philip supported Conrad, he had to take the other side?
Yeah, he did. Guy of Lusignan and his kinsmen were Richard's vassals in Poitou. Guy had done homage to Richard, Conrad hadn't.
Yeah, but who wants the Lusignans anyway? Guy and his brother had gone to Outremer in the first place because they had been exiled by Henry II for having killed Earl Patrick. They were trying to kidnap Queen Eleanor of Aquitaine, and Earl Patrick was trying to protect her. And remember, the young William Marshall was wounded and taken captive when he tried to avenge the death of his uncle Patrick. I mean, I knew we could get William Marshall back into this.
Hey, I'd be disappointed if we hadn't. Okay, Richard probably preferred to have a grateful Guy as King of Jerusalem than a discontented Guy back in Poitou. It may not have mattered all that much to Richard who held the title of king. Richard was de facto ruler of what remained of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. It was under his military leadership that the cities of the coast were being retaken from Saladin. That is, it didn't matter until Richard received word that his brother John had driven Richard's justiciar, William Longchamp, out of England, and Philip Augustus was taking advantage of Richard's absence to seize disputed borderlands and castles. Richard sent Walter of Coutances, Archbishop of Rouen, to sort things out in England, but he knew that if the situation at home continued to degenerate, he would have to leave the crusade. And that made it necessary to resolve the question of the kingship. In mid-April of 1192, Richard called together a council of the army and put the matter to a vote. Conrad was their unanimous choice.
I mean, after all, they knew Guy.
So bowing to the inevitable, Richard accepted Conrad as king. Richard felt some responsibility toward Guy, who had once been his vassal. As a consolation prize for the loss of his kingdom, Richard sold Guy the island of Cyprus at the bargain price of 60,000 bezants. It salved Guy's wounded pride and allowed him to remain a king.
Poor Cyprus.
No, Guy actually turned out to be a pretty good king of Cyprus, and the House of Lusignan would rule Cyprus for the next 3 centuries.
So Guy did have some good qualities after all. Who would have thought it?
Meanwhile, Richard sent his nephew Henry, Count of Champagne, to Tyre to give Conrad the good news. Conrad was ecstatic, as were the people of Tyre, who prepared themselves in the town for the festivities of a coronation. But the coronation did not happen. A few days after learning that he had been elected king, a very happy Conrad was murdered.
Happy? About being murdered?
He wasn't happy to be murdered. He was happy that he had been elected king.
Okay,
give
we're
me
back.
A break.
Come on, we're back where we started. Come on, we know that Conrad was killed by 2 members of the sect of assassins, but we still don't know who hired them. Do the sources provide any information about the assassination that can help?
That depends. There are several sources, both from the Christian and Muslim sides, and they don't agree.
What a surprise. Okay, what are the sources and what stories do they tell?
So I'll start with 2 Christian sources. The first comes from a near contemporary poem written by the Anglo-Norman poet Ambroise, who accompanied Richard on crusade and wrote about it. This poem was also used with slight changes by the author of the Itinerarium Peregrinorum et Gesta Regis Ricardi, an account of the pilgrimage and deeds of King Richard. According to Ambroise, a few days after Conrad received the good news, he was returning from a feast with the Bishop of Beauvais, absolutely cheerful and in good humor. Told you he was happy. When he, at the head of his party, reached the toll house, 2 young assassins threw off their cloaks, rushed up to him at great speed, and repeatedly stabbed him in the stomach. The Marquis fell dying from his horse. One of the killers was caught and immediately beheaded. The other hid in a nearby church, but he was found and closely questioned.
A euphemism for torture?
Yes, torture.
I was afraid of that.
And confessed that he and his companion had been sent there a long time before to carry it out and did it because their superior commanded it and because they would win salvation through their obedience. Those young men had been in the Marquis's service for a long time, awaiting a suitable moment to carry out the deed. They claimed that they had been sent by the master of the Syrian assassins, the old man of the mountain, Rashid al-Din Sinan. Sinan, they said, judged that the Marquis ought to die and had instructed that he should be slaughtered within a certain time. In the same way, the old man of the mountain brought about the deaths of all those whom he reckoned unworthy to live.
Wait a second. We keep talking about the sect being called assassins. Is it really because they were addicted to hashish? And why was their leader called the old man of the mountain?
Okay, they're actually Nazari Ismailites, specifically Syrian Nazari Ismailites. The term was not applied to the parent Persian branch of the sect. The title Old Man of the Mountain is also used only in Syria. Old Man, Arabic Sheikh, was a term of respect. The mountain refers to the Syrian mountain fortress of Masyaf. The Old Man of the Mountain, Rashid al-Din, was in his 30s when he assumed that position.
Okay.
Assassinus is how Latin chroniclers translated the Arabic Hashishiyah, literally hashish user. But most serious historians reject the notion that the assassins got high on hash before going on their missions. As Bernard Lewis points out, none of the medieval Arabic sources, whether Sunni or Ismaili, represent the assassins as intoxicated by drugs. Sunni commentators criticize them for their heretical brand of Islam and violation of Orthodox religious obligations, but not for taking or eating hashish. Latin chroniclers of the Crusades emphasize their unquestioning obedience to the Old Man of the Mountain because of their belief inculcated from childhood that the Old Man had the power to grant all of his faithful followers the joys of paradise. The first suggestion that the assassins took drugs appears in the late 13th century travels of Marco Polo. Marco Polo visited the ruins of the Persian Nazari Ismailite stronghold of Alamut and was told that in the old days, the Old Man of the Mountain maintained a beautiful secret garden attended by lovely young women. In his palace, he trained the most promising young men in the region, ages 12 to 20, daily telling them about the paradise they would receive through their fidelity to him. He would then have them drugged with a sleeping potion and dragged by his men into the garden, and when they woke up, they would seem to be in paradise. They'd stay there for a few days, then they would be drugged again, they'd pass out, they'd be carried back, and they would have thought that they had been in paradise for those days. Marco Polo's story of a sleeping potion was turned into the legend of the assassins as drug-fueled fanatics by an early 19th century French orientalist by the name of Sylvestre de Sacy, who first established the etymology of the name assassin.
Okay, that makes sense. It never made any sense to me. I mean, if you were drugging people and putting them to sleep, you'd think you'd be using opium poppies. And neither that nor hash would seem to be the ideal chemical accompaniment to a military operation. I mean, just say.
Nope. I think you're absolutely right. It's
Not that we would know, but...
Okay.
Anyway, back to your text.
Bernard Lewis and Dr. Farhad Daftari, the co-director of the Institute of Ismaili Studies in London, suggests that hashishiyah should not be taken literally. It was also used at the time as a term of contempt for the rabble, and that may have been why it was applied to the Nazari Ismailites by their enemies.
Okay, that makes sense.
It might also be a metaphor for the perceived wild behavior of these people. The Nazari Ismailites themselves use the term Badanites to describe themselves, and this simply means followers of an esoteric doctrine.
That's sort of like the Gnostics, the Christian sect.
It is. And they have some things in common. And those that were called to do the killings were known as Fadi, self-sacrificers.
Does that mean suicide?
No, it's tempting to identify them with the modern suicide bombers, but the assassins respected Islam's strong injunctions against suicide. These missions were dangerous, and it was even likely that the Fadi would lose their lives carrying them out. But death was not certain. The Fadi were willing to sacrifice their lives for the faith if necessary, but did not seek death, sort of like Christian martyrs.
Okay, back to the story.
Okay, so the dying Conrad was carried to his palace, where he received the sacraments. He told Isabella to guard the city of Tyre and not surrender to anyone except King Richard or, quote, someone to whom the kingdom belonged by hereditary right.
Meaning Isabella's next husband?
Maybe.
Okay.
Conrad then died and was buried in the hospital of St. John with great mourning. The French, who hated and were jealous of Richard, spread a false rumor, quote, fabricated by a poisonous tongue, a hateful hissing in the people's ears, that accursed King Richard of villainously bringing about the Marquis's death. He had hired assassins with money and sent those two homicides to do the deed, end quote. The French also warned Philip Augustus that he should be on his guard, as Richard had sent assassins to France to kill him.
Like they would be able to blend in?
Yeah.
They, right, anyway.
It was false, but apparently it terrified Philip, or at least that's what this particular source says.
Okay, that's one Christian source. You said there was a second. Does it differ from this?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
Of course it does,
everything.
Right?
Yes.
The second is the mid-13th century Old French continuation of William of Tyre's History of Outremer. The continuator gives the assassins a completely different motivation. Quote, "It happened one day that a merchant ship from the Saracen lands belonging to the Lord of the Assassins arrived at Tyre. The Marquis, who had need of wealth, sent his men to the ship and had them seize it. When the Lord of the Assassins heard that the Marquis had taken his men and his property, he sent word telling him to return them. He refused. Again, the Lord of the Assassins told the Marquis that he should watch out for it, for if he did not return them, he would have him killed. The Marquis replied that he would not return them. So the Lord of the Assassins went and ordered two of his men to go to Tyre and kill the Marquis.
Okay.
When they got there, they became Christians, or at least they appeared to become Christians. One of them stayed around the Marquis and the other around Balian, whose wife was Queen Maria and who was living in Tyre. Now it happened one day that the Marquis Isabella, the Marquis's wife, was at the baths. The Marquis did not want to eat before she had finished. But he was then told that she was going to stay longer at the baths. He was hungry, and so he mounted his horse together with two knights and went to the house of the Bishop of Beauvais, intending to eat with him, if the bishop hadn't already eaten. When he arrived, he found that the bishop had eaten, so he said to the bishop, "Sir Bishop, I would have joined you for your meal, but since you have already eaten, I shall return home." The bishop said that if he would like to wait, he'd be happy to give him something to eat. The Marquis replied that he'd rather go back. When he came outside the gate of the archbishopric at Tyre, that is near the exchange, and was halfway down the street, where it is narrow, the two men were sitting on either side of the road. As he came between them, they rose up to meet him. One of them came and showed him a letter, and the Marquis held out his hand to take it. The man drew a knife and plunged it into his body. The other man, who was on the other side, jumped onto the horse's rear and stabbed the Marquis in the side, and the Marquis fell dead. He was buried in the house of the Hospital of St. John. Although Conrad's murder was the result of the insult and injury he had done to the assassins, the continuator continued, Richard was widely held to have been responsible. It was said that he had arranged for the assassins to kill Conrad and persuaded the Old Man of the Mountain to send assassins to kill King Philip of France. Others blamed King Guy because of the way Conrad had humiliated him when he and Queen Sibylla came from Tripoli and wanted to enter the city of Tyre, and he prevented them.
Okay. Do we know where the continuator got the story that Conrad was killed in revenge for having seized a cargo vessel and men belonging to the Old Man of the Mountain?
We actually do. It's based on a letter purportedly from the Old Man of the Mountain that Richard presented to the Holy Roman Emperor Henry VI when he was Henry VI's prisoner.
Okay, remind me, so why was Richard Henry VI's prisoner?
Richard had so many powerful enemies that it was virtually impossible for him to get back to England without traveling through territory belonging to one of them. He ended up trying to go overland through the territory of Duke Leopold of Austria.
Oh, we remember him.
Yeah, the guy whose banner he threw down from the ramparts. Supposedly, Richard and his company were traveling in disguise, either as pilgrims or merchants, depending on the source. But his identity was revealed because of his lavish expenditures. He may have looked like a merchant or a pilgrim, but he spent like a king. He was taken prisoner by Leopold and held for a year until Leopold basically sold him to another of Richard's political enemies, Henry VI of Germany. Henry VI had claimed Sicily as part of his Holy Roman Empire and was really pissed by Richard's support of Tancred.
Okay, I get this, but how did they get away with imprisoning a crusader? I thought the whole idea was that if you're on crusade, you have immunity. That's one reason why people who committed crimes went on crusade.
You're absolutely right. And Pope Celestine III rose to the occasion and threatened to excommunicate the emperor. Notice I said threatened.
Okay.
He didn't feel really comfortable going straight up against Henry VI, so he threatened to excommunicate him, and he contented himself with excommunicating John instead.
John? Don't you mean Duke Leopold? I mean, not that John didn't deserve it, too.
Good catch. I did mean Leopold. Pope Celestine could make his point a lot more safely by excommunicating Leopold. Leopold couldn't hurt him. The emperor could, yeah. The excuse that both Duke Leopold and Henry VI offered the Pope for violating the protection afforded to a crusader was that they weren't arresting a crusader, they were arresting a murderer.
Richard, so the idea was that you have immunity on crusade from previous crimes, not from new crimes.
Or crimes you've committed while on crusade.
Okay.
Richard was to be tried and convicted of the murder of Conrad of Montferrat, who happened to be a cousin to both the Duke and the Emperor, as well as to King Philip Augustus of France.
Conrad seems to have been related to all of Richard's enemies, and even that wasn't enough to save him.
And that brings us back to the story in the old French continuation of William of Tyre. It refers to a purported letter by the old men of the mountain to Duke Leopold on behalf of Richard, clearing Richard of any blame for the killing of Conrad of Montferrat. The letter concludes with the statement, quote, "You should know for certain that we never kill anyone in the world for reward or money unless they have previously harmed us."
Yeah, right. I mean, why would the old man of the mountain send a letter like that to Leopold?
He didn't.
Okay.
The letter's an obvious forgery, probably concocted by the English royal chancery, and perhaps was even written by a royal clerk, Master Philip of Poitiers, who had accompanied Richard on crusade and whom Richard would then make Bishop of Durham upon his return. That it made its way into the old French continuation of William of Tyre meant that by the 1240s, the letter was accepted as authentic in both France and Outremer. We are told in the continuation that Philip Augustus, who had feared that Richard had sicked the assassins on him, wrote personally to the old man of the mountain in 1195, and again, the old man of the mountain exonerated Richard.
That makes even less sense than the first letter. But okay, Christian evidence isn't enough to make a decision on. You mentioned there were also Muslim sources?
Yeah, and they're contemporary Muslim sources. So, okay.
But I gather they're not what you'd call conclusive either?
If they were, we wouldn't have a podcast.
Okay.
Okay. Baha ad-Din's story is pretty close to the old French continuation of William of Tyre, except that he has the assassins name Richard as the instigator of the murder.
Okay.
Imad al-Din al-Isfahani, Saladin's chancellor, describes the murder in his biography of Saladin. Quote, "The Marquis ate and drank, sated and solaced himself, and went out and rode his horse. Suddenly, two men fell upon him like two mangy wolves, and with their daggers stopped his movement and struck him down near those shops. Then one of them fled and entered a church, having put out that vile soul. The Marquis, at death's door, but still with a flicker of life in him, said, 'Take me into the church,' and they took him in, thinking that he was safe there. But when that one of the two murderers saw him, he fell on him to finish him off and struck him again blow on blow. The Franks seized the two companions and found that they were two apostates of the Brotherhood of Ismailites. They asked them who had commanded them to commit this murder, and the assassin said it was the King of England. They also said they had been Christians for 6 months and had begun a life of asceticism and purification, frequenting churches and living lives of rigorous piety. One of them was in the service of Ibn Bazin, that is, Baldwin of Ibelin, and one was in the service of Raynald, the Prince of Sidon, so that they could both be close to the Marquis, ensuring his confidence in them by their constant presence. They were both subjected to cruel punishments and were reduced to the depths of degradation. An extraordinary case of two unbelievers shedding an unbeliever's blood, two criminals killing a criminal." I like
okay.
that. It's sort of overwritten, but that's his style.
Okay.
He was considered a great stylist in his day.
Okay.
Imad al-Din then immediately denies Saladin's complicity, pointing out that the death of Conrad was not to Saladin's interest, as Saladin was using the Marquis against Richard as he negotiated with both of them simultaneously.
Yeah, if he'd waited a little longer, wouldn't have been a problem. Okay. It's interesting that Imad felt it necessary to explain why Saladin wouldn't have been behind the murder. Clearly, he was responding to people who were pointing the finger at Saladin.
And he was. We know that. We have a third Muslim account of the killing. This one is by the historian Ibn al-Athir, who also served Saladin as a soldier, but whose political loyalties lay with the Zengids of Syria, Saladin's great rivals. According to Ibn al-Athir, quote, Saladin made contact with the head of the Ismailis in Syria, namely Sinan, and encouraged him to send someone to kill the king of England. If he killed the marquis, he would have 10,000 dinars. They were unable to assassinate the king, and Sinan did not see any advantage for them in doing so, being eager that Saladin should not have a mind untroubled by the Franks and thus be free to deal with them.
That makes sense.
He was greedy to get the money, so he inclined towards killing the marquis. He sent two men disguised as monks who became associated with the Lord of Sidon and Balian's son, the Lord of Ramla. They were both with the marquis in Tyre. The two stayed with him for 6 months, making a show of piety. The marquis became acquainted with them and trusted them. On the above date, the bishop at Tyre gave a banquet for the marquis. He attended, ate his food, drank his wine, and left. The two Batinis, who we have mentioned, Batinis simply means esoterics,
yeah.
We have mentioned, leapt on him and wounded him severely. One of them fled and entered a church to hide, a chance that the marquis was carried there to have his wounds bound. The assassin attacked and slew him. Both Batinis were killed in due course. Even though the assassination was at the behest of Saladin, the Franks themselves attributed the assassination to the King of England, for he wished to become the sole ruler of the Syrian littoral.
Okay. Now, at least the accounts overlap. We can say with some confidence. One, Conrad was murdered in Tyre by two men on April 28th while returning from dining or trying to dine with the Bishop of Beauvais.
Good.
Two, these men were Nizari Ismailis. That is, they belonged to the Shiite sect known as the Assassins. They were disguised as Christians and may have prepared for the killing by joining the retinues, either of Conrad or nobles close to him months earlier. Three, the Assassins were caught and killed. Four, one of the Assassins under questioning may have implicated Richard. But whether or not that happened, the French Crusaders spread the rumor that Richard was behind the killing. Five, some Muslims believed that Saladin had paid for the killing, while Richard and his supporters claimed that the old man of the mountain, Rashid al-Din Sinan, chief of the assassins, had ordered the killing on his own behalf to avenge a wrong and insult that Conrad had committed against the assassins.
Good, good. That's a good summary. And we can add to that that there were others who blamed Guy, citing the public humiliation he had suffered at Conrad's hands when he was denied entry into Tyre after his release by Saladin.
You mean he couldn't defeat Saladin in battle, but he could kill a fellow Christian?
Yeah.
Okay.
Surprisingly, no one seems to have thought that Humphrey of Touraine, the jilted husband, was behind the murder.
You mean the man who would not be king? I mean, I don't see him having the nerve or even the motive to do it. And besides, it's not that Conrad's death would bring Isabella back to him. I mean, she was the living token of the kingdom.
Yeah, and she didn't go back to him. Humphrey apparently did mourn the loss of his bride, but he didn't do anything about it. 8 days after her husband's murder, Isabella married Count Henry of Champagne. 8 days, with the blessings of King Richard and even the French.
You mean they needed somebody to be king and they needed it fast. And Richard was on his way out of town.
Yeah.
Okay.
Henry was nephew to both King Richard and King Philip. And on the crusade, he was Richard's loyal lieutenant.
So Isabella so far has had three husbands and she's only 20.
Yeah. She ended up with four in all.
Okay. We can leave Humphrey off our list of suspects. And I also don't see what Guy would have hoped to gain by Conrad's death. I mean, he already had Cyprus and he wasn't going to get to be king again. What about Henry of Champagne? I mean, Conrad died only a few days after he met with Henry, and Henry married the widow about a week later. I mean, if you ask cui bono, maybe he benefited.
Possibly. But I don't think that Henry would have done anything without the approval of his uncle Richard. On the other hand, the old French continuation of William of Tyre does say that Henry, after he became ruler of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, and after Richard had departed for England, visited the old man of the mountain in his fortress at Masyaf to make peace between them.
Whether or not Henry was suspect in the murder, that seems like a prudent thing for a king of Jerusalem to do.
It's a great story. In that story, the old man of the mountain demonstrates to the impressed and appalled Henry the absolute fidelity and obedience of his men by ordering a series of them to step off the walls of the fortress and fall to their deaths.
That sounds about as plausible as the hashish part, but what do I know?
Yeah, it's the same story that we see in a chronicle from about the year 1175, so I wouldn't take it too seriously, but it's an indication of just what the Crusaders and the French saw as this fanatical devotion of the assassins to their leader, to the old man of the mountain.
It also sounds like they were terrified of leaving the coast for fear of the interior mountains where God only knows what enemies awaited them.
Yeah, I agree. No, I'm not fond of conspiracy theories. And for Henry to be behind this, it would have to be a conspiracy which would include Richard and probably also Isabella. It also presupposes that Henry would have been willing to forego returning to his wealthy county of Champagne to marry a pregnant Isabella carrying Conrad's child. Ambrose, who would have known, represents Henry as reluctant, given that Conrad's posthumous kid would be in line for succession rather than his children with Isabella, and had to be persuaded to marry the widow. I also love the idea that Imad al-Din seems to have been at that wedding.
Yeah.
And he was shocked when he saw that she was pregnant. And he turned to one of the courtiers and he said, "Whose child is that going to be? Who's the father going to be?" And he said, "It will be the queen's child," which leads Imad al-Din to comment to the reader, "You see the licentiousness of these foul unbelievers."
Okay. Well, okay, that leaves us with three suspects: Richard, Saladin, and the old man of the mountain himself.
Yeah. So let's talk about each, starting with Saladin. How about if you make a case for and I'll make a case against?
Okay. Well, if we can trust Ibn al-Athir, Saladin wanted both Conrad and Richard dead. Richard was too well protected, so the assassins took the easier target, Conrad. Conrad was a competent and popular leader, unlike Guy, whom Saladin had sensibly returned to weaken the kingdom further. And the deaths of Conrad and Richard would leave the Crusaders without a leader and make it easier for Saladin to regain whatever else he had lost to Richard, including Tyre.
Well, Imad al-Din makes an excellent point that it wasn't in Saladin's benefit to remove either of them, as he was able to play one off against the other. And if he wanted one dead, it would have been Richard and not Conrad. He had been able to use his negotiations with Conrad to extract a better deal out of Richard, who was by far the more dangerous opponent. Besides, I'm not sure that Saladin was that close to the old man of the mountain. Even after Saladin broke off the siege of Masyaf and Sinan stopped sending assassins to kill him, Saladin's goal was the unification of the Muslim world. Sinan's was the survival and spread of Nizari Ismailism, which Saladin regarded as a noxious heresy. For Sinan, the Franks and Crusaders of Outremer were a useful check on Saladin's ambitions. I don't think Saladin did it. How about Richard?
Actually, Richard sounds like the best suspect to me. I mean, Conrad was Richard's rival in Outremer, and Conrad had refused to give Richard support for his campaign. And Conrad claimed to be king and was negotiating a treaty with Saladin.
More like an alliance between him and Saladin against Richard.
Well, Richard was going to return to England to deal with John and Philip Augustus. And he wouldn't have wanted to leave all that he had gained in the hands of a man he didn't like or trust, and who was a kinsman and ally of all his political enemies. I agree it's unlikely that Henry of Champagne would act on his own. But his marriage to Isabella was not only in his interest, but that of his uncle Richard. And, not least, Imad al-Din states bluntly that one of the assassins under questioning named Richard is behind the killing. Not that one should necessarily trust things that are said under torture, but still.
And it seems to have been that the assassins were given cover stories in case they were captured. So it could well be that it was to mislead that
yes,
they had that story.
Okay.
The case against Richard seems pretty strong and was certainly believed by a lot of the Crusaders, especially the French. Duke Leopold of Austria and the Emperor Henry VI, as I said, justified violating Richard's Crusader privileges by claiming that they were seizing him to try him as a murderer of a Crusader. I'd add that according to Ambroise, Richard did not mourn the death of Conrad. Quote, "Since you tell me that the Marquis has met his inevitable fate, Richard said. What comfort will excessive grief bring to the living? How can mourning benefit the soul of the dead? I am delighted at the election of Count Henry as King of Jerusalem.
That's not so surprising. After all, Richard stood silent at the grave of his father, Henry II. Maybe he was simply good at appearing stoic.
Yeah, and that's a chivalric virtue, this idea of being able to restrain oneself, and that's majeure. But it also comes over odd in this context.
It certainly does. And what Richard, I mean, you're supposed to be defending him, right?
Yeah, I am. And so let me get to the job.
Okay.
I see no evidence that Richard had any dealings at all with Sinan, and certainly not a close enough relationship for Sinan to order a murder on his behalf. The one part of the forged letter clearing Richard that rings true is that Sinan and the assassins were not killers for hire. Despite the popular view of them, the only Christian leader they actually killed before Conrad was Raymond II of Tripoli, and that was in response to Raymond having granted the Knights Hospitaller land near the assassins' stronghold of Masyaf. The assassins' targets were Sunni Muslim leaders, in particular Seljuk Turks, whom they regarded as the ultimate enemy. Sinan, in fact, attempted twice unsuccessfully to assassinate Saladin, probably in retaliation for a raid upon Ismaili territory. This in turn led Saladin to besiege the fortress at Masyaf in 1176. Saladin broke off the siege probably because he had to deal with the more immediate threat by the Franks. The two subsequently came to an understanding of mutual toleration. Kamal al-Din, a mid-13th century Arabic historian of Aleppo, relates a story justifying Saladin's toleration of what the Sunnis regarded as heretics. Supposedly, the old man of the mountain sent an emissary to deliver a message to Saladin. Saladin was surrounded by his Mamluk soldiers. The messenger insisted that he was to deliver the message to Saladin alone, who responded by sending away all but two of his most trusted bodyguards. The messenger again told Saladin that he alone was to hear the message, to which Saladin responded, quote, I regard these two as my sons. They and I are one, end quote. The messenger then turned to the two and asked them whether they would kill Saladin in the name of his master, to which they drew their swords and saying, command us as you wish. They were assassin plants. Saladin was so unnerved that he decided that although he enjoyed overwhelming military superiority, it was prudent to make peace with the old man of the mountain. The story is probably fictional, but it does make the point about the effectiveness of the Nizari Ismailites' asymmetrical warfare and terror. They were small enough and personally dangerous enough for Saladin to ignore.
Wait a sec. So we're down to only one suspect, the old man of the mountain himself.
Okay. Now, there are problems with the story that was told in that forged letter and that was copied into the old French continuation of William of Tyre. The assassins held no port cities, and the sources do not tell us that they engaged in trade. But we know so little about the sect that it's possible that they had merchant ships. They had to supply their stronghold somehow.
Well, they did control a lot of agricultural land around them, but that's not enough for everything.
I like the idea that Sinan had Conrad killed to avenge a wrong against the sect. He may have planted a cover story implicating Richard simply to foment distrust and conflict among the Crusaders. The more distrust and conflict among the Christians and Sunni Muslim enemies, the safer it was for the Nizari Ismailites. In 1192, Sinan was at peace with Saladin, but that doesn't mean that he wanted him to prevail. Certainly the killing of Conrad was an act of terror that showed how vulnerable the leaders of their enemies were. It was an act of terror meant not only to remove an enemy, but to impart terror. The reputations of the assassins as fanatical and unstoppable killers lives on today, in altered form, in the video game Assassin's Creed and its spin-off movies.
Oh, I knew you were going to get a movie in here somehow.
Of course I'm going to get a movie in. Okay, but I'm going to do the game. Assassin's Creed 1 is set partly in 1191 and is loosely based on history. The graphics aren't bad historically. The 9 victims that the fictional assassin Altair ibn Lahed is assigned to kill as penance for violating the Assassin's Creed are all historical figures. The assassin's maxim in the game, "Nothing is true, all is permitted," was supposedly the last words uttered by the great Persian elder of the Nizari Ismailis, Hassan e Sabah.
Wait a minute. I thought the beat writer William S. Burroughs said that.
He did. He apparently got it from a 1936 French book about the assassins by someone named Betty Boothall, who I've never heard of before. I associate it with Nietzsche, who also put it in and attributed it to the assassins. I tried to track the quotation down, and I found it in an 1838 English work on the assassins, but I couldn't find an Arabic or medieval Christian source for it. "Nothing is true, all is permitted" may be linked to Master Hassan II's announcement in 1164 of what he called the resurrection, the advent of an age of spiritual enlightenment replacing Sharia.
That sounds like the antinomianism attributed to the Anabaptists and to Anne Hutchinson.
Yeah, and also a lot like early Christianity's dispensation of the Mosaic Law. And by the way, great word, antinomianism, dispensation from the religious law. Religious legalists accused antinomians of hedonism. If everything is lawful, everything is permitted. Therefore, let's party. And that's how the doctrine of the resurrection was represented by the enemies of the assassins, whether those enemies were Sunni, mainstream Shiites, or Christians. And they may have had reason to believe this. Sinan had to deal with some followers who interpreted it as license to drink and engage in sexual debauchery. He corrected their error sternly. A source of the maxim may also have been the Shiite principle of taqiyya, that under compulsion a believer may dispense with fulfilling obligations of the law.
I think I can safely assume the video game isn't faithful to history.
A good assumption.
Yeah.
The game may have a historical backdrop, but it's even less historically accurate than Kingdom of Heaven. In fact, it's less historically accurate than the 1954 Hollywood potboiler, King Richard and the Crusaders, with George Sanders as Richard the Lionheart, or as he's called in the movie by his fictional niece, Dick Plantagenet.
Oh, please.
And Rex Harrison, Sexy Rexy, as Saladin.
Oh, no.
The game has as its protagonist Altair, who assassinates Conrad's father, Walter of Montferrat, instead of Conrad. This just didn't happen. But it's a minor historical problem compared to the major historical problem at the very heart of the game, a great secret that is the fuel for the entire fantasy series, a centuries-long struggle between the advocates of freedom, the assassins, and the advocates of order, the Templars.
Oh, give me a break. Do all conspiracy theories have to involve the Templars?
Yeah, they do.
Okay, wait a sec. Now, before you answer that or start talking about games and movies that I haven't and never will play or see, and before we start getting enmeshed in these historical issues, we run out of time again. So is it your conclusion that the old man of the mountain ordered the killing of Conrad for his own reasons and not on behalf of anyone else?
I guess I do. But you know, I could be wrong.
Yeah. And my culprit is still Richard, because it's the kind of thing that an arrogant ass like Richard would have done.
I hope you mean Richard the Lionheart.
Yes, sweetheart.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you'll listen in to our next episode.